Charlottesville's Habitat Store hosts a talk series called Green Matters, exploring the benefits and methods of living green and making our homes and communities more earth-friendly. This is a recording of January 9th's talk called It Pays to Be Green. Carl Brenn of Green Visions Consulting and Mark Watson of Piedmont Housing Alliance explain affordable ways to go green and available tax credits.
Welcome. My name is Ryan Jacoby. I'm the Director of Retail Operations for the Habitat Store, and I am very excited to see all of you tonight. This is our sixth workshop in the Green Matters series, and I see a lot of new faces, which is always very nice to see, so welcome. Also, a special thanks to both the AV Company and Festive Fair for their continued support. And lastly, I just want to mention that our next workshop will be on February 20th. It's titled Smart Landscaping, and it will provide a comprehensive look at everything from site selection to development of the site, orientation, xeriscaping, pest and weed management, and many other aspects. So hopefully you'll be able to join us for that one as well. I will go ahead and introduce our first speaker. We've got two excellent speakers tonight. Carl Brenn is president of Green Visions Consulting, which provides consulting services related to the application of green building and sustainable design. He is a lead accredited professional with the U.S. Green Building Council and has been involved with green building and sustainable development for over 10 years. Carl currently serves as the executive director of Earthcraft Virginia, a nonprofit that administers the Earthcraft Residential Green Builder Program throughout the state of Virginia. Carl is the founder and was president of the Virginia Sustainable Building Network from 1994 to 2004. He is a founding board member of the James River Green Building Council and the Better Housing Coalition. He is also a member of the board of directors of the Virginia Conservation Network and was appointed to the Governor's Energy Policy Advisory Council by Governor Tim Kaine in 2007. And I'm lopping off the rest, even though there are a whole bunch more qualifications. But please join me in welcoming Carl.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I begged him to tell you that I went to Flat Rock Elementary School, but he didn't care to put that in. But I actually did. It was called Flat Rock Elementary. But let me get myself keyed up here real fast. Slideshow. You can tell by my gray hair that I'm technologically challenged, but I usually are able to get it. There we go. Well, good evening, everyone. Mark, I thought this was a energetic group that's going to save this planet. So now we're going to try this one more time. My name is Carl. Good evening, everyone. Woo! Wow, little Shakti right up the spine there. It's really great to see everybody. Actually, I do that about 98% of the time when I speak, and only one time would they must have been real surly or something. They would not respond at all. And then you just kind of go on from there. You know, it's going to be a bad night, so thank you for helping me out on that. We're going to talk for a few minutes here. I think we're given about 20 or 25 minutes at the outside, and want to go through some things with you. As I understand what Ryan basically wants to talk about is about green building and particularly its application to affordable housing and any comments that I have along those lines and to give you some of my perspective on that. Let me just say before I start is that I kind of came from the affordable housing world when I first got in this. I used to work at VHDA for many years as a nonprofit affairs director. I worked with nonprofits all across the state. And have been working with homeless issues for a long, long time. And so that's kind of where I came from. My professional training, I shouldn't tell him. He left out that I went to Virginia Tech. But, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And in planning. But so I've been involved with those. And when I discovered green building, I actually discovered it about 15 years ago. I was at a Habitat house, and it's very appropriate that we're here in the Habitat store. I had attended a workshop in a place called Omega Institute. Anybody ever been to Omega? I know what it's up in Rhinebeck, New York. Oh, I could tell them. They got that glow on their face right back there. About 15 years ago, in the early, about 93 or so, 4. And the people teaching the class, do you know David Gershon and Gail Straub? I don't know. We got to stop doing that. Anyway, but they were very committed environmentalists, and the workshop had nothing to do with that, with the environmental, but they were. And somehow I had kind of a transformative moment. I realized I had to do more than just recycle my bottles and cans, that the challenge to this planet was too great. And that's really before I knew anything or much was talked about global warming or global climate change, quite frankly. Now, some people knew about it, but Al Gore did, but I didn't. But I realized that there were so many things going on. Didn't know what I was going to do, however, because I had been kind of the housing field. Came back 2 or 3 months later. I was down in Lynchburg visiting the Habitat for Humanity down there, a guy named Kevin Campbell, wonderful person, was in charge. He was the executive director. And boy, did he build houses down there. Man, he built 20 or 30 houses at that time in Lynchburg, and that was getting some stuff done. He got funding to build a green habitat house from Louisiana Pacific. Some guy talked them into doing green back in those days. Well, they were way ahead of their time, too much ahead of their time, so they dropped it after that. But he got most of the funding and most of the materials to build a green habitat house, and he had to build it to certain principles. Well, it's pretty rudimentary by today's standards, but I kind of got the concept, and I just knew that's it. And so I've been involved with it ever since and plan to spend the rest of my life doing this, which may not be very long. Let me start out. I always insist, and Mark and I were talking about this just before we got started. This is not just a nice thing to do. It's not a fad. We must do this. Our planet is really challenged. We are in danger. We may not, next 10, 20, 30 years, we'll see dramatic changes in this world. We're already having them, but it's going to be even greater. And so we must do this. My piece of this, and maybe since you're here tonight, maybe part of your piece is the green building part. I can't do anything about everything. I can't tackle all these issues. But this is my piece of it. And to me, the most single, most efficient and effective things that we can do in the short run is to increase energy efficiency. That's the big piece of the pie that we can tackle. We need renewable energy. We need a whole bunch of things. But those all take longer, quite frankly. Now, we could do them. I was listening to Lester Brown last night on a podcast, and he's put out his Plan B 3.0. And basically he was saying, look, we must, and you probably have heard this if you are tuned into this very much, it's not a new thing, but he was very emphatic about it, is we need a World War II approach to this. You've probably heard the story is right after Pearl Harbor, FDR brought in all the automobile makers and industrialists and says, look, he gave them this list of how many planes, tanks, you know, went to ships, tonnage, we got to produce this. And they said, well, Mr. President, you know, I don't think we can do this. I mean, we want to do everything to help you, but, you know, we're producing about 3 million cars. He says, no, you're not. We're not going to produce any more cars. You're going to produce this armament because we've got to win this war. Well, they didn't produce a car for about 4 years. They did it. I mean, they far exceeded all of these goals. Well, and we know the rest of what occurred. And he says, in terms of environment, we've got to have exactly that same mentality. And unfortunately, we don't yet. And I'm hoping that we will. Let me go forward here. Okay, I'll make sure I got this right. There we go. Who knows what that is? This is a test. All right. Well, that's Mother Earth. That's Spaceship Earth, they used to call it back in the old days. Best as we know, there's only one of them like it. And that's the one that we're on. There's Ray Anderson, who was a leader in this in sustainability. He was a carpet maker, still is, I guess. And he kind of got the message from Paul Hawken and said, you know, this earth was created to get sweet enough. Isn't that a nice thing? Sweet enough so it can sustain life. A lot of times, and I actually forgot it, Mark, I usually bring a basketball. And I say, and I put one piece of saran wrap around that basketball. The biosphere in which all life is, it's not way out into space, there's not much life out there that we know of, is thinner than that piece of saran wrap around that basketball. And that's what we're fouling big time. Man has never been able to do this before, They probably would ruin the earth before this if they could have. But they've never been able to do it on the level that we can now. And that's exactly what's happening. Let me go forward a little bit. Well, I won't dwell on this. And you know about the studies that came out this last year about the global warming. If anybody doesn't believe it, they're in a rock and they're, you know, I don't start with them. You go with the people that listen. The real reality is that the global climate change, what was the high temperature here today? Well, it's about 70-something in Richmond, and I was down in Atlanta today, it was about 75 on Monday. I realize, you know, it gets warm here. It's not unheard of, but it happens a lot. We just don't have much cold weather anymore. Well, you've seen this cover. Be very, very worried. It's true. The global, the Antarctic, Greenland, all these places are melting, all the glaciers around the world. It's accelerated. That's the thing that's happened in the last several months. All of these things that happen at a much faster rate. Now, this is not a very attractive chart, but here's the point. Up here, that right now, we have about 385 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If almost all scientists agree, if it gets to 450, we're into uncharted territory in terms of what might happen with the Earth. That's the race that we are on. It's a race. And they build one little indicator. They build one new coal-fired power plant in China every 8 to 10 days. Think about it. My first thing was, how do they do that? And we're had a hearing yesterday, I guess, or day before on the new Coburg, in Wise County that Dominion is proposing. And there's like 150 of them proposed in the United States. And all of that's up there. Now, if they can do it, and I mean, there's a whole bunch of objections, but the point is, this is mostly unbridled in the world. Buildings. Buildings are a huge contributor to a global, to carbon dioxide and to greenhouse gases. I won't go through that. If you ask the person on the street, ask them, well, where do you think it most comes from? Well, they think it comes from cars. And, of course, cars do contribute a lot of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Buildings are by far much more. I hear the figure 47-49% of all greenhouse gases comes from buildings. The heating, cooling, construction of buildings, it's a huge contributor. The idea, folks, if we can reduce that down big time, we got a chance. Tom Friedman, I don't agree with Tom on everything he does, but he's a smart guy. And this was in January of 2006, and he's been writing about green. And he says, being green, focusing a nation on greener energy efficiency and conservation is not some, he actually, his original version was girly man issue, but I figured that's kind of gone out of style. So I put frivolous issue. It is actually the most tough-minded, geostrategic, pro-growth, and patriotic thing we can do. Green is the new red, white, and blue. So if you wanted another reason to be green, put up that American flag. Because that's exactly what you're doing. You're doing the most patriotic thing you can do for this country. And there's a lot of deep thinking about this. I mean, many people think we fund both sides of the Iraq war, but I won't get into that whole topic. Well, unless you've been under a rock, you notice green is in. And every magazine, newspaper, TV show, good grief, it's everywhere. So that's a good thing, because still, if you ask 100 people out on the street, They wouldn't know much about it. So believe me, when you're trying to bring about a real revolution in thinking and acting in a country, you've got to do a lot to get there. Well, more magazines, guys. I get about half of these, unfortunately, but I need to cancel some of them. I can't read them all. Well, these are just some of the major elements of green building. All green building has about the same major elements that it addresses. It addresses the site, things that you do on the site. Water is a big deal. When the water, I was down in Atlanta, and if you remember here back before Christmas, they were within a couple of months of running out of water for Atlanta. Now, how do you plan for that? Now, you know, I think Orange, the town of Orange up here, when we had a drought here 6 or 7 years ago, if y'all remember that, they basically ran out of water for that small town. Well, they could kind of truck it in, and they got by until it rained. What do you do with Atlanta? Folks, that's a big place, and there's a lot of water. They're still in danger. I mean, quite frankly, it's rained a little bit, but it's nowhere far. What if this happens? So you got to have water. Big deal, and you can do a lot to save water. Waste management is a big deal for all kinds of reasons. Material use, materials back here, I see nature neutral, but what you put in your building is terribly important. Indoor environmental quality, folks, that's a big deal. I was talking to a guy today at a restaurant I was eating. He's an environmental manager at federal agency that we'll go unmentioned. And we were talking about the impact of lead. Of course, he was talking about lead, because he was talking about lead paint and all this stuff. Well, lead's a very toxic material. I mean, it gets in your bones. It's not mercury, same deal. But all kinds of other elements that are in common stuff in our homes is very dangerous. We don't know the impacts that they have. So what green building does is try to address those principles. You can have your own list, but that's the primary ones that you deal with in almost all green builder programs. And basically, you try to reduce the negative impact on the environment. And you happen to also be able to save money and be more comfortable and healthier and all the rest. Here's some of the impacts of buildings. It's a little bit of the first one, but a little broken down. About 12% of the water use, 30% greenhouse gas emissions, 65% waste output, about 70% of electricity consumptions go into buildings. Here's some of the savings typical savings you get in green buildings. Now, this can radically different, but you're not talking about just a tiny marginal improvement. You're trying to make some, if you're going through the trouble, you might as well try to make sure you get some significant savings. Energy, of course, is a big deal because the energy not only affects the family and others, but affects the whole planet because of what's required to get that energy. Carbon savings, 35%. Water use savings, 30 to 50. We put in my church, I go to River Road United Methodist Church. I'm a Buddhist and a Christian, too. But just by the way, since I'm in Charlottesville, I want everybody to know that. But anyway, We did a renovation at our church 2 years ago. It's about $1 million renovation to the educational wing and our community room and so on. And I got on the building committee, not because I needed one more committee to be on, but I wanted to green it as much as I possibly could. And I didn't get everything I wanted, but we did get waterless urinals in the men's restrooms. And you would think that it's amazing. They still can't stop talking about it. Now, getting all those incandescent bulbs removed, that's a whole other campaign that I'm working on. But anyway, and of course, waste cost savings, huge. Now, the perception of green building, everybody here knows what that is. That is a green building, actually. It's a yurt. It's wonderful. But typically, you live in yurts here. That's a problem on the Mongolian plain somewhere, Mark. You probably live in a yurt, but most folks here don't. But anyway. But this is reality. It's a normal house. Now, it can be a very modernistic-looking house. It can be anything you want it to be. Green building, a lot of people really think that green is some weird something. They either think that it's a very expensive, modernistic-looking deal, it's like a spaceship, or they think it's made out of old tires and old windshields and beer cans. Right? I mean, it's a huge problem we deal with. But that's beginning to change, thank goodness. Now, I'm going to show you some examples from affordable housing, and I'll go through really quickly this. These are just some I happen to have that I've done or been part of, or we've done through the Earthcraft program. We've done lots of them all across the state, and I'll be glad to address that later. This is one I did about 10 years ago called Hilliard House. It's a facility for homeless women and children. I was the chairman of that board for almost 10 years, and we built that. It's a part rehab. That on the left is an old stable. And then the older house is, where the photograph is being taken, that's the courtyard around which it was all built, and it's doing just great, thank you very much. And it was built to Energy Star standards, low E windows, blown cellulose insulation, a whole bunch of things like that. Carter Woods, this is our first multifamily development we certified when we were doing three pilots here in the state on Earthcraft. And that's Carter Woods 2, the Better Housing Coalition, which I happen to be on their board of directors, have been for a long time. It's built to very energy efficient standards and all the other things built into it. It's a beautiful facility. Another Better Housing Coalition, this is in Church Hill. If you're familiar with the Church Hill neighborhood, these are more traditional houses that fit in that particular community. Now, those are new houses. They look like old houses. Now, we love to do that in Richmond, by the way. Yeah, if it doesn't look old, it probably doesn't fit in here. But we've got lots of those, and I know y'all do some beautiful houses here, too. This is in Withville. That's at the Withville Redevelopment Housing Authority. And those are some. They actually got some additional ones that are of a different style, but this was taken very early on in the process. This is a big rehab that was done on the tax credit programs called Blue Ridge Estate Apartments. It's actually in the city of Richmond. It's about 182 units. And those are just so much better. And I could go through all the things that were incorporated into that building. This was a for-profit builder, but based out of Boston, that was not all that thrilled about doing it. But I want to tell you something. When we had the dedication of this, I had the construction guys come up to me and said, "Mr. Brand, you know what?" He said, "I just love this." He says, "Now, I'm on another job now, but I'm taking the things that I learned on this project to that job." And the guy that was a manager came in and said, "Come here, I want to show this apartment." And he said he turned on the bathroom fan. And, you know, it was Energy Star, and it was, you know, very low sum. He says, "I know what a psalm is now." Listen, it's infectious. People at all levels want to be part of this. You got this. Y'all know Linda Lloyd. Is Linda still in the community? I should have guessed. Linda's very green. I love it. Linda built some houses, and this was an Earthcraft house she did, and I took that picture. Earthcraft, Lead for Homes, is here now. In fact, I was in Atlanta all day Monday doing some very extensive training on this, but we do Earthcraft, and we're kind of lucky here. We've got some choices, but you can build a house that's not a green builder program. I mean, you can do a very green house. The only thing I say is this helps people get through the process, and you can make some choices, and there's certain mandatories that you have to do that we think go to harder things, but we're really moving forward on this all over the state. Now, this is something I want to talk about, and if you're talking about affordable housing, Paul Hawson has a wonderful book. He came out last year called Blessed Unrest. It says, "The division between ecology and human rights is an artificial one. The environmental and social justice movements address two sides of a single larger dilemma. The way we harm the earth affects all people, and how we treat one another is reflected in how we treat the earth." The longer I'm in this, these two things are intertwined. If you go into some areas, you know, like in Central or South America, in which you got lots of very poor people, we're not going to save those rainforests if they stay very poor. People got to eat. You know, they got to make a living. And we could have a long discussion on this, but this is something I'm convinced we have to be part of. Paul did this study. It was millions of organizations working toward ecological sustainability and social justice. Paul said several years ago, he says, "When I realized this was happening, I knew we were going to win because it's coming from the bottom up." It needs to come from the top down, too, but... Margaret Mead, one of my favorites, says, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And you're that small, dedicated group of individuals, because that's how we're going to change it. Was at a Green Build, which is a U.S. Green Building Council's conference in Denver, which was the year before last, in Chicago last year. One of the speakers there was talking about we have about 10 years to really stabilize and start to reverse greenhouse gas emissions. And he said, that's 3,650 days. And it's kind of grabbed me in the gut. Does it sound a lot closer when you put it in terms of days rather than years? And that was about 2 years ago. We don't have that many days now. So it's something we must do, and let's pick our piece of it. You can do many things, but Green Belt is our piece. Then finally, you probably can guess who those guys are. Those are my grandsons. Actually, that was taken last Christmas. They're a little older than that, particularly little Jesse there. He's a big boy now. But that's Jack on the left, and that's Will on the right, and that's Jesse in the middle. And those guys are going to inhabit the world that we're going to leave them. And they're going to have to wrestle with this to a much greater degree than we will. And so that's my motivation. Let me make a few real brief comments. green is happening all over the place, and green building, let me just stick with that, is happening at places you wouldn't think. Just do by a couple examples. This morning's newspaper, Henrico County, where I live, they've had the same members of the Board of Supervisors for about 20 years. Five members have been, it's got to be a world record or something. Same five, four men, one woman, have been together for a long time. They all just had an election, and all of them got reelected. Anyway, and the guy, David Cackley, who's, I know, known him for a long time, was elected chairman of the board. They kind of rotate the chair, and it's David's time. He's probably been chairman 15 times so far. And they had in the paper, a little small article, he put what his priorities were. Well, he wanted to improve the health care in the county and reduce the health care costs for the county. And he wants to do energy efficiency and to do some green schools. I thought, wow! Now, we've been working on them. But that, to me, is an indicator of what's occurring. And I could give you many examples. Let me give you one other final example. I'll sit down and we'll talk about this. In Alexandria, they're building a new firehouse, big firehouse, four bays. They're going to have 60 affordable housing units on top of it. This is under construction right now. The firehouse is going to be a LEED certified, and the affordable units are going to be Earthcraft certified. Is that cool? So now you guys, if you need next fire station here, put some affordable housing on top of it, and we'll certify it. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you very much, Carl. We're going to take just a minute and I think quickly shift laptops for Mark. I'll go ahead and do the introduction. And one other thing I wanted to mention, tonight is our first attempt at podcasting the workshops. So a special thank you to Charlottesville Tomorrow. The goal is that as you get further along in the series, if you want to back reference some of the discussions, you can go on and access those. And also, if you can't make a particular topic that you're interested in. So definitely a special thank you to you guys. Please join me in welcoming Mark Watson.
Who is even more technologically like stifled than this guy. Even though my hair's not gray yet. I'm just going to lose mine, I think. I thought that I would stir things up a little bit. And you can see from the title that this is something that could easily get me dragged behind the cart. Actually, like bringing up the names of automakers. But I really do think that there's actually something that we can learn from both Ford and Honda. And it really gets to a concern that I've had about the exploding green movement. I have to understand, I'm 55 years old. I was a hippie. I had a long, I had a long red beard, and I wore overalls and boots, and I worked for Mother Earth News, and you know, we used to stand around and kind of laugh about the fact that nothing was really ever going to happen until someone could figure out how to make money. And so it took 30 years, and we finally figured out how to make money. But I think that what's happening is that this exploding movement may start to lose, or it's starting to lose its focus a little bit about where it all got started. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. Let's see if I can get this thing to move. First thing I want to talk about is Piedmont Housing Alliance. I worked for Piedmont Housing Alliance almost 6 years there. We did just spin off a profit-making, tax-paying company called Central Virginia Development Solutions that will be handling the next few large projects in the pipeline that we've got. They're all going to be mixed income. instead of just affordable workforce type housing. We're at 501, Piedmont Housing Alliance is a 501c3 regional community housing development organization, similar in a way to Habitat, but regional in size. We have jurisdiction kind of over the city of Charlottesville and the five surrounding counties, Albemarle, Nelson, Luvanna, Louisa, and Green counties. But we did build the first ENERGY STAR certified home in the city of Charlottesville back in 2002. And we were the first affordable housing developer in Central Virginia to build an Earthcraft house back in 2005 and 2006. And we've partnered with the UVA architecture and engineering schools on two local ECOMOD projects, ECOMOD 1 and ECOMOD 3, which we have just finished up, which are projects trying to create affordable, green, modular buildings that can be used as prototypes to go to the modular housing industry so that they can generate them in mass, basically at a lower cost, hopefully. We are, our organization is a member of the EPA ENERGY STAR program, Earthcraft program, U.S. Green Building Council, and the James River Green Building Council, National Association of Home Builders, Blue Ridge Home Builders Association, Virginia Sustainable Building Network, and the Congress for New Urbanism. So we're very concerned with building green, building sustainable homes, and sustainable communities. I'm prefacing all of what I'm going to say with this saying that we're kind of on board. So where we've been now as a world, not just PHA. So green building concepts are at the most basic level kind of simple and logical, right? They've been used for centuries by individuals and societies of disparate means in every corner of the earth. And since the time of our earliest ancestors, in fact, I mean, even animals that aren't our ancestors, have been finding ways to stay dry during them when it rains and cool when it's warm and warm when it's cool. What happened? Well, my old professor Ian McCard would say that humans are a cancer. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but a lot of things happened. I mean, once people started to move, started to take over other societies, change latitudes, change longitudes, change elevations, they started to incorporate their type of homes into the new areas. It's all inefficient. They didn't just adopt the type of building that of the area where they were taking over. And then, of course, we had colonial style or imperial style planning and overly zealous zoning created, you know, just laying out a blocked street over a topography that doesn't really deal with blocks very well. I mean, if you look at the maps of old cities, you'll find that they followed cow paths. That's where their streets were. They kept with topography. So no one was just laying, you know, moving earth. We had industrialization and mass marketing in the 1870s, the one-size-fits-all type mentality, or the new and improved issue. It's where we had machine over nature. Automobiles and road construction in the 1920s allowed humans to avoid to have to deal with environmentally destructive actions because they could move. If they just messed one place up, they could just move somewhere else. Banking practices, being able to borrow money to build housing was something that the regular person wasn't able to do until the 1930s. I mean, that's why people stayed intact and lived in the same houses that their parents and grandparents lived in. discovery of oil. Petrochemicals, 1872. Plastics in 1909. Well, just one of the many things that all of that allowed was the automobile to affect the development of land. Centralized power supplies, Thomas Edison, 1882, permitted the widespread development of rural areas. Refrigeration and air conditioning, 1902, which I think is one of the worst things that ever happened. See, we don't need it. It's not in here. See, we're doing fine. So we allowed homes to be constructed using inefficient construction methods. Oh, here are some voices of reason and change that have been calling to us over the years. Thoreau's Walden, Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold in 49. Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring in 62. Ian McCarg in 69 with Design with Nature. The publications Organic Gardening and Farming by Rodale Press in the 60s and the Mother Earth News in the 70s. And then specifically about green building and the efficient use of materials and energy. Design for the Real World by Victor Papernick, a landmark book that really led to McDonough's Cradle to Cradle book. If you read some of that book, it's just absolutely amazing how prophetic it is. Well, here's things finally changed. We had the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts in 68. As Carl showed, that photograph of planet Earth, we didn't have a photograph of planet Earth until late 60s. We couldn't see what it looked like. And we certainly couldn't see how it was changing until later. And so the changes were seen over time, but only since about 1969. The true recognition of climate change really happened with Al Gore. I mean, everyone was talking about it back in the 70s. It got lost in the 80s somehow. But basically, it's finally starting to, like, the light bulb finally went on, you know, but the big one down the bottom is people finally figured out how to make money building green, doing green things, living green. So where we are now, we've got the Energy Star program. It's by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Very minimal type of a program that can save a tremendous amount of energy and resources if properly implemented. It just needs to be, and it's being accepted by virtually everyone at this point. Any new house that you see will probably have Energy Star components in it or methodologies in it. The EarthCraft program goes further. It starts to look at durability, starts to look at health issues that the Energy Star program doesn't. It's more complicated, but still very simple. But both of the Energy Star and EarthCraft programs have recently been updated and have become a little bit more stringent as more information has become available. LEED is an incredibly complex but very important type of a program that is still in its stages of development. I mean, there are technical workshops being given all the time. Professionals like Carl who are taking the test to become certified. LEED professionals, but if you go to a workshop, you'll get a manual that is probably what, 1.5 to 2 inches thick. It's mind-boggling how glazed over you can get looking at one of those books. And this is, it's basically being these workshops are being attended by very high-level professionals. And it's complicated for everyone at those workshops. You can only imagine how difficult it would be to have an uninformed or less educated individual trying to figure out what to do with something like that. So there are many other similar specification and monitoring programs being administered throughout the country. Green Build Expo in Chicago this year, which was administered by the U.S. Green Building Council, had 20,500 attendees. That is one of the largest conferences in the country. And we've got a growing green building industry with mass marketing capacity and web-based information, which is just, could bury you. Now, these are some of the associated costs with those programs. You've got organizational chapter membership dues that your organization or you as an individual have to pay in order to become part of the program. With some of them, you've got project application fees. You've got commissioning or project oversight consultant fees. You've got integrated design process consultants, which add cost to the projects. Testing and rating professionals who do the testing and rating process, those costs. The verification that you did everything that you said you were going to do, and then the certification process, that cost money too. And you have the variable green upgrade costs that depend on exactly what you're doing, whether the project is large or small. And then you've got the costs associated with learning curves. Now, a small builder that, or a small organization like PHA, we hire small contractors to do our work. So if we don't hire the same guy every time, we have to train the next contractor every time to do the work. Now, that's not the case with a larger builder who has their own staff, but basically you've got time costs and learning curve costs associated with doing any green upgrades. But these are the cost benefits. Tight specifications, integrated design, the testing, the monitoring, all save on construction, energy, and resources, and create healthy environments for users. And you have durable, energy, and resource-efficient, healthy buildings. They create advocacy. The users become your advocates. The builders, the contractors, become your advocates. So that's a huge positive aspect to this, these programs. Cost detriments, though, are that the complexity exclude and discourage the use of green building concepts by the uneducated or uninformed builder or user. There's additional passed on upfront costs, and they may be very small, but they're going to add to the already problematic affordable housing problem that we've got in this country right now. Our at PHA, in the past 4 years, our client base has quadrupled in size. Basically, what we try to do is provide housing to what used to be just called affordable housing. Most people perceived affordable housing as being a housing for poor people. Now affordable housing is for all of us. I mean, we're basically the workforce. We can't afford to buy housing anymore. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm 55. I got into the market back in the 80s. But I look at my kids and I wonder, how in the world are they ever going to buy a house? I have no idea. And I'm sure most of us know, or most, you know, maybe a lot of you are in the same situation. So, anyway, we've got... But the big thing down at the bottom here is when the process of growing the industry becomes more costly than optimizing the use of the green building concepts in the field. So it's kind of a problem associated with the exploding green movement in the country. But here's a good example. And this is something that I don't know the answer to. Green Building 2007 had 20,500 attendees. Now, when you think about what the carbon footprint of all of those people on jets or in cars or however they might have gotten to Chicago, and all of the garbage they generated in that one place, and how much fuel it took to get the food into that conference center. And, you know, back in the 80s, we all talked about computers and the future of video conferencing, and that someday we wouldn't actually have to talk to each other face to face. We could do it over the computers. Whatever happened to that? I mean, we're traveling more for business now than we've ever traveled in our lives. Something is very wrong with this picture. We can't afford to do this if we're going to say we're green. So I think we're experiencing kind of an example of the law of diminishing returns, where the amount of input that's going into this is actually starting to diminish the output. This is where we started to learn from Henry Ford. He revolutionized the auto industry with the production line. The real contribution was the realization that making a small amount of profit from more buyers was better than making a large amount of profit from fewer buyers. In other words, implementing many small green improvements have a greater impact than a few large green improvements. I heard recently that if everyone in the country just changed one incandescent light bulb to a compact fluorescent bulb, we would save 7 million barrels of oil a year. Now, these big projects are great, but I think we need to get back to the small incremental changes. Honda, 78, they initiated one of the most successful marketing strategies in automobile history. We make it simple. I don't know if you remember that. Backed it up with a product that fulfilled the promise. Now, I happened to be looking for a car back in the 1980s, 84, I think. And I looked at a Camry and a Saab 900. Same price. Same dealer was selling it. I went in and I drove them both. And I said, so the dealer, you know, what's the deal here? Which one should I buy? And he said, well, look at that Camry over there. He said, that car, you'll drive that off the lot. And other than for just normal maintenance stops every 15,000 miles, the next time I see you will be when you drive that in to trade it in for another one. So that Saab over there, I'll see you all the time. So they backed it up, and they're still backing it up. Decreasing complexity in the product minimizes the product or process failure and encourages the consumer use. Do everything you can to make the product or process simple to understand and easy to use and maintain. I've got some proposals. Now, some of this gets beyond green building, but it all is hooked together. We have to initiate intensive, expansive, nationwide passenger and freight rail construction program to decrease the need for vehicles and roadway construction, and to take the place of short-distance air travel. They're losing money on those anyway. They'd love to get out of that stuff. And give tax credits to developers, builders, and individuals who use local, which is a big thing just over the past few months, is starting to really gain some strength, which is great. Durable, energy, and resource-efficient products and processes. The state should encourage localities to develop denser communities. They should go up Charlottesville. We should go beyond nine stories. It will decrease the need for extensive utility infrastructure and increase the viability of mass transit so we can get out of these cars. It should give tax credits to developers, builders, and individuals who use the local durable and energy resource efficient products, and we should encourage the development of light rail. The local government should rezone residential areas to permit the construction of and sale of small accessory structures and encourage universal design. Everybody know what universal design is? It's basically designing a house that can be lived in by anyone so that you don't have to modify the house if someone who may be disabled or elderly has to live in the house. And aging in place. Wouldn't it be great if we could all actually live in one house our whole life and not, when we're 65 or 70 years old, have to move because we can't make the stairs? And just think about all of those single-story houses that have been designed and built and have sprawled all over the landscape to accommodate people who can't live in their existing house. That would really slow things down a bit. Facilitate the dissemination and installation of small energy-saving products to individuals below 100% AMI. That's the area median income. And promote the widespread use of mass transit. Proposals for the green organizations. I'm doing this because I have no idea who's in this group here. So make the specifications easy to understand and work to make the program concepts accessible to everyone. That means not just the highly educated professionals who are doing design and construction. Facilitate the dissemination of grant funding to localities who incorporate the green building initiatives into the zoning and or building codes. A lot of these green building, universal design, health house type specifications could be incorporated right into the zoning codes. And assist the schools in educating the next generation of users to living, green living concepts, not just green building. Proposals for industry: make the product and processes understandable, durable, and maintenance-free as possible, and strive for quality and simplicity. Continue to work to refine the product or process, to increase its efficiency and longevity, and work with your trade organizations, basically, to test your product. Make adjustments as necessary to increase the quality. Proposals from developers and builders: incorporate simplicity, passive design, not just active design. Universal design, Healthman, you can read it. Build smaller houses, less than 1,200 square feet. Piedmont Housing Alliance recently did an analysis of its database. We basically have a home buyers database that of people who are in various stages of preparedness to buy a home. So we do big stat sheets on them and found out that 54% of the prospective buyers are 1- and 2-person households and 78% are 3 or less. We shouldn't be building 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 square foot houses. We don't need to. On the first EcoMod house, we originally planned it to be a single family detached house, but the site was a little odd. It dropped off quite a bit. Topographically, so the crawl space wound up being about 8 feet high. And so we thought, why don't we just finish off a slab and stub out a basement apartment down there and maybe they'll finish it later. And then the appraisal came in on the house. That was $282,000. And it was too high a price for us to put an affordable buyer into the single family house. So I thought, how in the world can I deal with this thing? And it wound up that because we had stubbed out this basement, I was able to create 2 condos, and I finished the basement. Well, the basement was only 515 square feet. Well, the upstairs, which was probably 1,300 square feet, stayed on the market for probably 2.5-3 months. I sold the bottom unit in 4 days. The demand is tremendous for these units. We could sell these units all day. It's just a it's a fallacy that people want these big houses. If we detail the houses properly, make them energy efficient, people will buy small homes. It's a much more European type of a way of building. Proposals for individuals. I mean, these are pretty simple. Seek out low-tech methods for saving as much energy and water as possible. Educate the family to save water and energy. Use those IRX and state tax credits and local tax abatement programs to help with the upgrade costs. A lot of people just let those things go by year after year, and they're there, and just save your receipts, and you can get some tax breaks. And encourage your local, state, and federal representatives to promote energy tax credits. Last words. We need to keep up the great work. All of us in the industry are trying as hard as we can to make this thing work as fast as we can. Time is running out, just like Carl said. But we have to remember that the basic green building concepts are simple and logical. We just want to touch the earth lightly. That was a favorite expression by a good friend of mine, Glenn Murkett, an architect from Australia. He used that all the time. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.